So I've got an idea, even if you didn't add more teams to the playoffs, that I know you would love.
Okay, so we'll save it.
Welcome once again to another special edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. The bonus edition, shall we call it, Elliot Friedman. It seems to become a sort of specialty around these parts. Last week with Brian Boyle, this week with one of the more outspoken, candid, and interesting players in this past generation in the NHL, Andrew Ferentz.
You know, I'd also like to hear from the listeners about this, because one of the conversations we've been having about our podcast is, do they get too long? Right. And I like the idea of maybe one podcast of news and one podcast with a guest. So tell us how you feel about it.
Yeah, see, I've always been of the mind that just give them volume, 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 and you can either listen to it or you can fast forward to whatever you want to listen to, or go past things you don't want to listen to. But I understand that people only have a certain amount of time to listen to a podcast, and as selfish as I want to be and as arrogant as I may be and say, well, of course, to listen to a two-hour podcast, this is me and Elliot, damn it. I do understand there are certain realities that come along with people's consumption of entertainment.
This is the eye test versus analytics argument in podcasting. Yeah. We think the eye test is okay. You'll listen to 2 hours of us.
Yeah.
But the analytics have shown our workers here, John Grigg at Sportsnet, that maybe that might be a bit too long. So I think this idea works. As for Ferentz, you know, Andrew is a really interesting guy. He's got a lot of different interests, I think broader spectrum. And people say, well, he's more open-minded than your average hockey person. I think that's almost, I think it's ridiculous when it comes to this, because I think he's got a lot more interest than your average human being. And I remember, and we'll talk about it with him in the interview, way back in 2004 when he was a member of the Calgary Flames in the Stanley Cup Final, one of the things players talked about with him was they realized very quickly that this was a guy with a very unique set of interests, and it wasn't unusual to hear some much different debates taking place in the bus, in the room, on the plane.
Talk to one of his former teammates on the way in to work today. And I said, when I say Andrew Ferentz, what comes to your mind right away? And this guy said, rides a bicycle, not like a bike, but like an old school bicycle to the rink every day. And big hemp seed guy. That was the first thing that came to one of his ex-teammates.
Him and Riley Cote.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Him and Riley Cote. So I'm with you. I've always had a soft spot in my heart for people in the NHL, specifically players that don't just give you the baseball hat answers and aren't just interested in talking about hockey issues, but that use that platform that they have to talk about other things. I don't like the shut up and play guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just here to play hockey and stay onside and score my goals and try to will this team into the playoffs. I like guys that'll give you a little bit more. I like thoughtful people. What have we always said before? I like to collect interesting people in my life. I think you're the same way, Elliot.
Yes.
And Andrew Ferentz is clearly one of those people. Amongst the topics discussed in this interview that Elliot and I did, the Edmonton Oilers, what happened with that last incarnation of the Edmonton Oilers, the Boston Bruins, their playoff run in 2011, what Montreal Canadiens fans thought of Zdeno Chara specifically, the hockey glove malfunction, and carbon footprints in the NHL. With that, we present our interview with Andrew Ferentz. Brought to you by the GMC Terrain. Okay, welcome inside the Sportsnet Ice Surfing Studios, one of the mini studios that Elliot Friedman and I use for the 31 Thoughts podcast.
Yeah.
And we reserve this one when we have special guests, namely someone who is, make sure I get the business card right here, working for the NHL, doing social impact, growth, and legislative affairs. You may know him better as the former NHL defenseman with Calgary, Pittsburgh, Boston, and the Edmonton Oilers. Please welcome Andrew Ferentz to the 31 Thoughts podcast.
It's fantastic to be here, and I'm surrounded by Bruins memorabilia, which is fantastic. Thanks.
Made you feel comfortable. Memories of 2011. We're going to get to a lot of those Boston Bruins stories, I assure you. But I got the business card right. Social impact, growth, and legislative affairs.
Yeah, and my kids look at me with like complete confusion when I say that.
I only have my BA, so explain what that means.
So it's a new department that the commissioner put together with my boss, Kim Davis, who came in January. I came in March, and it really does cover everything that's said there. We do everything from Hockey Fights Cancer to our diversity and inclusion, Hockey is for Everyone programs, all the way to government work in Ottawa and D.C. A lot of the stuff that I do is built on infrastructure support for places that, you know, our game is played. And not just like pro arenas, but community rinks and all the way down to street hockey. So,
if you knew when you were playing that you'd be doing this post-career, would you have done anything differently? Or does this seem like a natural progression?
Oh man, I think this is kind of what I wanted to do. Yeah, I mean, I always had stuff going on outside the game. Some of it was directly related to hockey. I mean, I did a lot with NHL Green and the environmental work. So I had counterparts at the NHL that I knew well, had different connections through my union work, you know, whether that was through CBA negotiations and whatnot, but made relationships at the NHL through that. So I was had a bit of an eye on the NHL, and my last 2 years when I was playing in Edmonton, I actually finished up some school through Harvard Extension, through corporate sustainability, innovation, so put some meat on the bones around some of my environmental work. And, you know, I thought the commissioner would like that too if I was trying to twist his arm about giving me a job at the league. So I always knew I was going to do something, and I never liked traveling on buses and putting on the miles on the road. So I was pretty sure that scouting or, you know, coaching down in the minors or in junior was not in the cards for me. So, staying in the game in some way or another, you know, you're somewhat limited after that, and business is the way to go.
So you were a member of the Calgary Flames team that went to the Stanley Cup final against Tampa in 2004. And one of the players on that team told me that you and I think it was he mentioned Iginla and the late Steve Monador used to have some pretty epic conversations about things that would not normally be discussed in dressing rooms or on planes. Like he said, and I hope I have the people right who would be involved in these conversations, but there would be things like the Middle East peace process or stuff like that. Like people, he said that guys would turn around and look and say, what on earth are these guys doing back there? Is that true?
Some of the best conversations of my life, probably. Jerome is a fantastic debater. And you rarely find people in your life that you can have really deep conversations with, especially if you, on some of those conversations, have opposing views and still get along great. You know, I think it is actually pretty rare when
it's a lost art.
You can talk openly and talk deeply about subjects, not necessarily agree, and still really respect each other. I mean, it was fantastic. And to do that in the setting of a hockey room, locker room, what I liked most about that is the fact that it was Jerome and it was our leader on the team. And, you know, imagine being a young guy in the room like that and seeing the leader of your team having an interest outside of the bubble of the hockey dressing room. I mean, I always preach that, but it's different when it comes from a guy like Jerome. You know, so the example that he said about, you know, being more than just a hockey player, I love that about him, and I love that about our conversations and things we talked about. And
give me the wildest, like, what was the craziest topic that you guys solved or discussed?
You know what? Like, the one I hang over him all the time is we talked really early on. It was back when the NFL, I think, was doing a lot with United Way. Like, NFL was kind of known to be, like, that was their thing. And at the time, the NHL really didn't have a thing. You know, there's a bunch of guys. We're doing all of our, you know, our own private stuff and this and that. And so I told him, I'm like, we need to get behind the environment and climate change. And as a group, like, that can be a thing that we really, you know, put a stamp on and say it's important. You know, we play on outdoor rinks, our ponds, you know, we're part of nature. Our game starts there. So I had my whole debate, you know, and I forget what he was arguing for or against, but, you know, he thought it should be something else, whatever it was. And shortly after, you know, really with Omar Mitchell at the NHL, we started NHL Green and, the you know, had a carbon neutral program with the players and whatnot. And so now it's still flourishing, and we've won some awards, you know, for the environmental work that we've done at the NHL. So, you know, I can wink at him on that one and know that I kind of got him on that one.
So who is the biggest climate change denier in the NHL? That's what we want to know.
Man.
You don't have to answer that.
But that's a. It's actually a good. Nobody's come out of the closet on that one. Maybe Tim Thomas. He'd be up there.
Oh yeah, he might.
You know
be.
What?
He's up there on a lot of things. Though.
I want to get when we get to the Boston Bruins stuff. I do want to park some time and talk about Tim Thomas. We had Jack Edwards on, and we asked him about Tim Thomas. He is one of the more interesting characters that we've seen in the game in the last 20 years. But back to that original point about, you know, carbon credits, how tough a sell was that for you in the NHL? I mean, that was, listen, it's been said before, you don't become great until you marry yourself to something that's greater than yourself. And that's clearly a movement that's greater than any one individual. But how tough a sell was that as, you know, here I am, NHL defenseman, talking about something as significant, serious as climate change and pitching, you know, carbon neutral and carbon credits for NHL teams?
Surprisingly, way easier than I thought it would be. That's for sure. I mean, I knew that I was definitely in the minority, and this was back in the day. I mean, it's not like it's in the news like it is today, or with the urgency that it is today. Back then, I mean, you know, we gave it some thought. I met with David Suzuki a few times and talked about it, and did all the stuff at home, you know, that you're kind of supposed to do, and composting and recycling. And you know, credit to him, he pushed me to say, like, you know, shame on you. You know, you're in Canada playing hockey, you have a chance to stand for something. And if you don't take advantage of that, you know, well, what a waste. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with hockey players where they should be a role model, you know, because I've played with a lot of guys that probably shouldn't be role models. But I think that there's an opportunity to be a role model. So I think, like David suggested, I think it is a shame if you don't take advantage of that in a positive manner. So we talked about going carbon neutral, adding up all the travel and hotel stays, and it was a pretty straightforward process, you know, as far as getting it done. So I pitched it to a few guys in our team, and Jamie McLennan and Steve Monador and Jerome and I think Marty Jelena, Rhett Warner, Robin Regier, I think I got everybody who was that initial group. They all said, yeah, this sounds like the right thing to do. And I think that's how we approached it, you know, it's a good positive thing, and we should do something. It's not the answer or the cure all, but it's kind of, you know, putting a bit of a flag in the ground and saying this is something that we care about. The next year, the PA really liked the idea, and we had a few guys reach out to us. And actually, some of my friends within the PA said, you know, this is a fantastic idea. Here's what we want to do. We just want to do it for everybody. We'll get everybody carbon neutral. And I actually pushed back against that, and I'm glad I did, because I said, you know, the point's not really going carbon neutral. It's the kind of the volunteer aspect of it, of guys putting their hands up and putting their credit card down and saying, yeah, this is important enough for me to say yes to and to opt into. And I thought that voluntary aspect of signing up to go carbon neutral was probably the most important part of it, you know, because that might trigger something in them to do more down the road or to speak about it. And so we stuck with the more voluntary mode, and we had like 500 some guys, you know, sign up out of 700.
That's great.
You know, kudos to the PA for spreading the message during their fall tour and explaining it to the guys, but I was shocked, and it still shocks me. You know, I think that that many guys did that, you know, because it was really quite unprecedented.
Now, first of all, my favorite game I've ever covered of yours was the glove malfunction.
Yes. Okay,
so use the ironic quotation marks around malfunction, first of all.
So let's set the scene. You guys are down 2-0 in that series, first round against Montreal.
Yeah.
And that was one of the best first round series I ever covered. Nathan Horton scoring in overtime in game 7 to win it. And did you score a huge goal? Was that a big goal in Montreal?
Yeah, it was a big goal in Montreal.
And you gave the finger to the crowd.
Yes.
And then at the end of the game, first of all, I couldn't believe you came out to talk to the media. Like, I was in the room. I was astonished when they told me that you were going to talk. And then so you said your glove malfunction, and yep. I tweeted it out, and I walked to the bar, and Glenn Healy looked at me and goes, how could you tweet that? You know that is total BS. How could you even tweet that? I said, Glenn, I got to report what he says.
Oh, and Glenn hated me too, because we were button heads at the PA.
Yes.
So I remember his commentary after I did it. I watched the game, and he was just roasting me on there too.
I'm like, he was.
Play it slower, Glenn. Thanks a lot, man. So it was obviously contentious. Bruins, Montreal, I could probably fill an hour of stories of that rivalry, of the things that my wife witnessed in the stands, and you know, Montreal semi trucks parking outside of our hotel honking horns and people throwing stuff at us and rocking our bus, and you know, the stuff they'd yell at Chara on the walk towards the game is like absurd, right? So I mean, it builds up.
But we're gonna ask you about all this after.
It's insane.
Tell this story.
So obviously emotions are running high. Earlier in that shift, I got hit by somebody.
Across the zone, Gianta and Ferris shoulder to shoulder. Gianta throws Ferris off balance and takes the hit to move it.
And you know, all the fans banging on the glass and you know, yelling at me and stuff like that. And so I went down the ice and just got a lucky kind of bounce and you know, putting up on Price. And
quick shot, Camilleri the block. Ferris scores! A little bit of garbage and Ferris skates right onto it and pummels it past the glove side of Carey Price. It's 3-2.
The Bruins won't go away, Jack. They had a really good stretch of 4 or 5 minutes where they had three high-quality chances.
Rolling puck for Ferris and he scores a goal. And, you know, that's good on him. He's got his team back in the hockey game. But it's what he does after he scores the goal that enrages me. And Andrew Ferris, you better get ready to open up your wallet, because this little act here after you scored the goal, your first one since 2003, isn't called for.
It was just primal emotion. Just, you know, one of those things, man. I don't know. There's no good excuse, but I looking back, I think it's hilarious. Like,
oh, yeah.
100%.
But
who came up with the glove malfunction idea?
So I probably shouldn't incriminate anybody, but I got called back into the back room where the coaches and everybody, you know, management and stuff is, and they just kind of played the video for me and looked at me and said, like, what are you doing? Because nobody on the bench knew I did it, right? Because, like, we're just playing the game, and so they're not watching TV. Like, they're just playing the game. And so they're like, well, like, you're going to have to say something. And I think it was that year, earlier that year, who was it on the Islanders? Somebody got suspended for a hand gesture, I think, towards Avery.
Oh, Jamie Wisniewski.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
So
yes.
I think he got suspended, I think.
Was it two? I think one or two.
Anyways, I mean, you're in playoffs and you're against the – like, you do anything you can to not get in trouble. So – like, true story, those were brand new gloves that game. They were legitimately brand new gloves. And I said, well, new gloves are stiff. mean,
just so happens the one digit didn't move.
So it was a terrible excuse. And it is actually, like, honestly, looking back, it's quite embarrassing. I should have just owned it and whatnot. But I was honestly scared to get suspended. And so I just lied, you know, quite frankly. And it's stupid looking back on it. But you know, in the heat of moment, you do a lot of stupid things to win.
Well, coach just showed me it tonight. It looks awful. I just saw it, and I'm sure that's not part of my repertoire. So I think, I don't know if my glove got caught up, but no, I can assure you, that's not part of who I am or what I ever have been. So it looks awful. I admit it. I completely apologize to how it looks, but I can assure you guys have covered me long enough to know that that's not part of my repertoire. I was putting my fist in the air, so I'm sorry. It does look awful. I just saw it.
So now my daughter, you know, gets Instagrammed, you know, like all the time. All her buddies at school all play hockey. So every time it's on, like, funny hockey clips or whatever Instagram account, like, best Sally ever, you know, she gets, like, all these messages from her buddies, and she's like, oh, thanks, Dad. But even better part of that story is we go back to Boston, and I lived right in the North End, so, you know, the Italian neighborhood. And I go to my condo, and on the buzzer board, you know, where you buzz in to get into the building, all these envelopes are taped to my buzzer board, and they're full of money. And so the people in the neighborhood
pay the fine.
And so there's messages like, that was the best game ever. Go Bruins. You know, all these things, you know, all these great messages from my neighbors and from the people of the neighborhood. So I might have came out on top. I don't know, but yeah, it was all right.
So what did they say to Chara?
Oh, well, I can't say it on here. It was in English and it was horrible, but you can't censor it.
How did he react to it?
Well, he's fine. He's,
I mean,
like,
he's heard it all going back when he came over and
veins.
Played Prince George. So,
but I mean, you walk down the street and there'd be like some little Montreal guy poke his head out of a store and, you know, call him, you know, a pretty derogatory thing and then just like run around the corner, right? Like, it was like poke the bear and run kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he would just, you know, ice in his veins, but you know, he can't blend in. He's got it rough, you know, everywhere he goes.
One of the more interesting stories, that was such a fascinating team and a fascinating time in NHL history with that Boston Bruins squad. And one of the more interesting ones to me, Andrew, was a game against Dallas, and Danny Pallie catches Ray Suata, and it's a hit to the head.
Welcomes him to the NHL. Suata wondering which way is up. And now here we go. Ferentz takes a pop. Somebody was coming in defense of Suata. And he's still stumbling around, not well balanced at all.
Yeah, that was Thornton that grabbed him. It was Sotheby that came in there. There was a penalty call on the hit by Pallie. And this will be a question whether it was from the blind side or not on the back check.
And normally in a situation like that, it's, you know, protect the hive and all the players jump to the player's defense. And, oh, I know Danny and he wouldn't do that. And Pallie's not that kind of player. And right away you said, hold on a second. And I'm paraphrasing you here, but you said, we can't be hypocritical. We didn't like the Savard hit. We didn't like the Bergeron hit. So we can't like that hit. That's almost unprecedented. And I remember on Hockey Night, you know, Don Cherry had a go at it. Mike Milbury had a go at it as well.
Danny Pallie's big hit on Ray Suata's big talk in the NHL, Don. What'd you think?
Well, he's going to get suspended. You know him. Watch this here. Go ahead. But he did hit the shoulder and then come up. But I guess this is what they're going after. And the kid wasn't knocked out because he holds onto the puck. But you can't come to the blind side anymore. But look at him with his head down like a dum-dum. And he hits the shoulder and he comes across. If you show it after, you show it again. He grabs the puck. Watch. He's not knocked out or anything. But you're going to get. But you know what got me after this, Mike, when I was talking? What really got me, the guy that got me on this whole thing was Ferentz. You do not, I don't care if your teammate is an axe murderer, what you've got to say to the guy that's there. You go in the dressing room, you tell him that was a dirty hit, dun, 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 dun. But you wouldn't do that anyhow. You never go to the press like Ferentz did and say that was a bad hit. The kid's going to lose $23,000 over that. They don't need a guy like Ferentz. And I'm going to tell you something. I'd hate to be in that dressing room right now. See what happened to the game today? 2-0. That brings your dressing room down when you have a guy in the dressing room talking about your own players and you know it's going to get suspended.
Can you take us back to that, that game against Dallas and the subsequent, because there was a whole, don't forget, there was a big talk at that time that what Andrew Ferentz said is going to divide the dressing room and this team will never win again. And take us back.
Well, like compared to flipping off and lying about it, you know, there's times when you actually do the right thing. And you know, I was with Kobe Bryant like about a month and a half ago at a conference. And, you know, I have a respect for him and, you know, people have different opinions about him, but he has a great thing on leadership. And he says that leadership can actually be pretty lonely because it means sometimes, you know, saying the tough things and saying things that everybody doesn't necessarily want to hear, but it's the right thing to say, you know? And so we had a room in Boston that was full of leaders and it was the best workplace environment I've ever been in. You know, people could be themselves. They could be honest. You know, not too far from, you know, some of the conversations we had with like Jerome and myself, like those kind of open conversations. Yeah. And so I was confident, you know, I had no problem with my room and my coaches and the guys in there. Quite frankly, in my whole career, I couldn't really care less if Don Cherry didn't like what I said or Mike Milbury. That's not a concern to me. The only concern was that you have the respect and the trust of the people within that room. So I talked to Danny Pye, you know, I talked to Danny about that. And I think even before I, you know, said anything to the media, and the Savard thing was horrible for our room. Right. I mean, just everything from, we didn't really feel like we got proper revenge, you know, however barbaric that sounds. Mm-hmm. You know, we lost the best player. We saw a guy, you know, whose life was turned upside down from a bad hit. So on and so forth. And I remember at that time being so pissed off, you know, not only at, you know, the Penguins, but every team that, you know, rushed to defend a guy on a really bad hit. And I get it. Like, I've been suspended and I argue for myself about how the hit's not as bad as it looks and this and that. So I get it. I get how it works. But I don't know. It was just kind of a turning point where I wanted so badly for, you know, for teams to quit being so hypocritical and at least, you know, nudge toward the middle of saying like, you know what, that that wasn't such a great hit. You know, we got to get rid of that in our game. And not crucify your own player, but still just have an ounce of credibility, you know, in talking about a really tough issue.
What was it like in the room after that? I think that was Super Bowl weekend, too. I can't remember who had
Honestly, I think it was no big
someone.
Deal, really. I mean,
that was the note that I got. She was like, you know, Merrick, it's not really that big a thing here in our room.
Well, and we had the type of room where everybody in that room knew you had each other's back. Something happened on the ice. Like, we probably had more quasi-line brawls and, you know, redemption.
Against Dallas,
like,
that same team. I mean, that kind of turned that year around.
You know, like, everybody trusted each other. Everybody knew that we were there for each other. And I think that, you know, if you're in that situation, like I said, I've been in that situation where you deliver a bad hit and you feel horrible. Like, it's a terrible feeling. If you hurt somebody or you do something and you get it, like when you're on your suspension call, you're going to, you know, try to get it as few games as possible. So you're kind of going to say whatever you can to get as few games as possible. But at the same time, like, you know if it's bad or good. And you know that it's hard to stand there in front of the media and just lie through your teeth and say, oh, it wasn't a bad hit. You know, like, that sucks too. So I don't know. It's a tough thing. You know, I'm not trying to say it's easier, that everybody should just be honest about it, because I don't know, that doesn't necessarily work. But for the better of the game, like, you need a dose of honesty when bad stuff happens and not just, you know, pure partisanship.
That was a great team to cover, that Bruins team. There were a lot of, you always knew if you had to pick someone to talk to in an intermission or after a game, there was always someone to talk to. You had a lot of different personalities, and it was a really good group. I remember being on the bench for my pregame hit, game three of that Stanley Cup final. So you lose the first two games in Vancouver, and game three, Vancouver goes out for the warm-up, and then you guys come out. And Sean Thornton, I'm watching this from the bench, and I'm like, what? Sean Thornton skates over the red line into the Vancouver end of the ice twice and play the puck. And Roberto Luongo is looking at him like, what the hell is going on here? And I've always been told that between game two and game three of that series, you guys had a pretty honest conversation where you said, if we're not what the Bruins are supposed to be, we are never going to win this series. Is that true?
Yeah, we had lots of honest conversations. It was a really special group, and not just that year that we won. You know, you go back the year before when we lost. You know, we lost after being up 3-0 to Philly, and some of the different playoff series that we lost together as a team with that core group of guys. And so we'd been through a bit together, and obviously it all worked out in 2011. But we're at a point, like I said, not too different from, you know, what we just talked about with Paille. But, you know, we're able to have really honest conversations. Char was an incredible leader that way, where, you know, he could bring out his best European, Eastern European, you know, wrestling dad voice, and, you know, really lay it on the line and say, like, we need more from you, and here's how, and more from you, and here's how. And guys had a black and white role and knew what was expected of them. The guys on the fourth line, you know, were so proud to be part of the best fourth line in the league. And, you know, all that, you know, just that real pride in knowing what your role was, and knowing that if you didn't play that role and up to the standards that was expected, that, you know, you could be called out on it, and, you know, nobody tiptoed around it. But, you know, in that series, you know, we had a few conversations. You know, obviously it was a massive momentum swing when we went back to Boston and got up a few goals, and we had the somewhat of a psychological edge, I think, just because of the, you know, goaltending, you know, when Luong was pulled and all the stuff that was happening, and we were able to get away with a lot of pretty physical play without getting called, and you know, the biting, and, you know, it was a nasty series, but, you know, our team thrived on emotion and thrived on chaos and, you know, thrived on being there for each other, you know, and so I think that definitely played to our favor. Probably the more consequential talk, though, was when they went up on us and came back to Boston for game six, because I had been in that situation with Calgary where, you know, we had a chance to win the cup in game six. And I knew that, you know, for the most part, I don't think any of those Canucks players had ever been there. And I knew from my experience that there's no way these guys are getting a good sleep. You know, they're up all night dreaming about their cup parade and what they're going to do with the cup. They just spent all day, you know, organizing all their families to come watch the game and get tickets and, you know, set up flights and organize all that crap. And so I shared that with the guys, you know, that was my experience. And if there was one thing I could do differently, it would just be the stupid things like getting a good sleep, blocking out all the distractions, and just, you know, just really focusing on the game. So I, you know, we had a big talk about that kind of situation, about how we went through that with Calgary, and about how there's no way we're going to lose that game because that's what these guys are going through. And if we could really pound them, like, we've got them mentally, like, oh, you know, X's and O's kind of rah-rah, all this kind of stuff. But it was true. And I think that was, you know, that played out. Obviously, I look like an oracle now. So
it's a great perspective, though. Like to that point, I mean, you were there. You know what those players went through. And to Elliot's point, what a fascinating team to watch. So many different, colorful personalities. Whether it was Zdeno Chara, who we've talked about so many different times here on the podcast, and elsewhere, Patrice Bergeron, a young Brad Marchand, yourself, and Tim Thomas. Let's get there. I'll ask you the same question I asked Jack Edwards. Who is, or maybe I should say, who was Tim Thomas?
Almost a guy like Iginla to a certain extent. He could actually talk about a lot of things and obviously had very different viewpoints than myself, but he always did it in a very respectful way. And he was pretty sure of his convictions and stuff that he believed in and what have you. And I always really respected him for that, you know, and it's interesting to meet people that aren't like you, you know, and you can have, you know, that's, I think, what makes the world interesting. And, you know, we don't necessarily have to agree with, you know, the stuff that he believed in, this and that, but we accepted him. And I think that was probably the important part, right? And damn, he was good at stopping the puck, too. So
played out of his mind. You do want to break it down. I mean, Chara and Bergeron, when they were on the ice together, nobody else touched the puck. And Tim Thomas was next level great.
He was next level great. And I think that when we won, it was, he had his idiosyncrasies and whatnot, but it wasn't a distraction. Like I said, we respected him, and I think he respected us, and everybody kind of did their thing and played really well. It did become a bit of a distraction with the White House stuff and the next year, and it kind of just elevated a bit to a point where it was a distraction to the team. I guess I'm retired now, so I can. But you know, I remember getting a couple, you know, called into the office. There's a leadership group on the Bruins, and we'd get called into Claude's office, and he would just be sitting there shaking his head and kind of flustered. And he would ask us. He's like, I need your help. He's like, I call him in here and talk to him, and he just calls me a communist. He's like, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. What do I do? What do I do? Like, and so he'd be all flustered.
Is Claude actually a communist? Like, so is Claude this fair would
be so he was calling Claude a communist. And I don't know why, but it's just, you know, he was an interesting guy. Like
we're
I said,
trying to talk about the penalty kill here, Tim, and you're calling the coach a communist.
But I mean, he was like I said, it's one of those funny relationships because, yeah, he was completely different, and you can't say like we're friends, but we all respected, I think, the fact that he's different and he's got his thing. And I think there's just that line that you cross when how much, you know, it impacts your team with your differences or different takes. And when it starts seeping into, you know, being a distraction, then it's tough.
Does anybody keep in touch with him?
Yeah, I think Luch does. I think Luch keeps in touch with everybody. He's probably the best at that. I think he's up in Idaho somewhere.
I heard it was Colorado.
No, but I think the altitude was like making him sick or something. Like, oh, for real, like, true, oh, story. Okay, yeah. Okay. So I think he's in Idaho.
I wanted to ask you about Lucic. Like, look, nobody's going to feel badly for a guy who's earning as much as he is, but I do feel badly because it's not working. And I think anybody who has any pride, and he has a lot of pride, it hurts. Do you talk to him at all about how it's going in Edmonton? Because I do think, even though he's obviously keeps it private, I do think he wanted to be traded last summer. I do think they tried. Do you talk to him at all, try to help him get through it?
Yeah, well, he's got as much pride as anybody. I mean, he absolutely loves being in the NHL. He loves playing an important role on a team. You know, I see the frustration, the same frustrations that I had too going to Edmonton about certain aspects of going there, and especially coming from, you know, a really dialed, when you've seen a dialed in culture and team and how it's operating, and you go to something different, it can be extremely frustrating. And I mean, you know, being from Edmonton and I grew up in Sherwood Park, you know, I've seen it a million times. Like, there's always a sacrificial lamb on the team that just gets roasted by the radio guys and the newspaper guys, and then the fans just continue that on. And, you know, I think he's obviously taken that, you know, a bit. You know, always got the target on your back with the big contract. And, you know, he'd be the first to admit that, you know, he should be getting more points and score more goals. Like, you get all that. But, you know, it's tough. You know, it's really tough to play there and to be, you know, I guess the center of so much negativity. And I don't care who you are, like, negativity gets to you and it doesn't usually help you at all. So it's tough for him. And I think that it's tough for any player transitioning from like a really super important role on a team to a secondary role on the ice. I think he's still incredibly important, like, in the room. And I think that's probably, you know, whenever I've talked to him, it's, you know, goals and assists, and sometimes your play can dip and change, and sometimes it's luck, and sometimes you're just kind of not playing so good. But you can always do the stuff in the room and create that culture and lead off the ice. You always have pretty much full control of that. You know, mm-hmm. that shouldn't dip and ebb and fall off the map. So I think for a guy like that, you know, that's where you have to maybe transition, where your role on the ice isn't so important, but your role off the ice and in the room and as a leader, you know, you have to magnify that yourself and really make yourself important in those ways as well.
Is it a feeling almost like of getting caught or getting trapped, where everything around you, I mean, this game changed, as you know, Andrew, fast. Like, this game changed quickly. Do you think he has the feeling that maybe he got caught, that, you know, he's the same player? Like, hey, this worked not that long ago. Why isn't it working now? That, to me, has to be one of the most frustrating feelings, not just in sports, but in life, because you didn't change. Everything around you did.
Well, everything's changing, yes. But, I mean, I think that, you know, there's probably not too many defensemen that still like playing against him. Him on the forecheck when he's all rambunctious and running around, I mean, he's not a fun player to play against. It's just that when you've had really successful seasons like he has, I don't know what his top-line numbers are in his best years, but, you know, you're not hitting those same numbers that you used to hit. You know, you're not getting the same playing time. You're not scoring as many goals. Does that mean that you're horrible? No. Like, I guess, is, you know, people, you know, will automatically look at your contract and have expectations where you should be, and so they should. But I think it's just some people might adjust their own personal expectations a little quicker than others, right? And just accept the fact that, you know, I'm not going to be that 40 goal guy, 22 minute a night guy, you know, so what can I do? And if you don't adjust that quick enough, yeah, I mean, the frustration will be never ending.
You mentioned it, frustrations about going back to Edmonton. I remember a game on hockey night where you were the after hours guest with Scott Oak, and Edmonton got pummeled that night.
Surprise.
Well, no, but the thing is, like, we remember watching the game on air and saying, Scott's not going to get the guest. Like, there's no way Andrew Ferentz is going to be on the set after this. He's going to have to scramble and fill 30 minutes. And you showed up, which was great. And then, but you were really hard on them. Like, you lit up the group, and you've talked about that. And I don't think anybody watching that game would have had a problem with it. But what you just said a couple of seconds ago, I think there's a lot of Oilers fans out there wondering, why doesn't it work? You know, they've had a lot of great talent in there. Is there something there in the water of Edmonton that contributes to all of this? Why do you think they've had so much trouble?
I mean, I don't think it's one thing. I mean, I think there's a combination of elements that go into it, right? I think that, like I said, that aspect of feeling like more scared to make a mistake and be the whipping boy rather than, you know, being bold and taking your chances and having that confidence to try, you know, to try the play, or, you know, I think some guys, you know, might get into that role of just being scared to be the whipping boy. You know, I don't know if that makes sense, but, like,
I have heard that you
take less risks. Your urge to win and be bold is less than your urge to not be the whipping boy or stand out, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is one aspect. I think that the quickness that, you know, radio or newspaper fans jump and attack their own guys is horrible. I think that the quickness to defend players within the organization, I remember, like, you know, Jeff Petrie or Schultz getting raked over the coals, and nobody coming to defend them, and then just trading them when their values, when they're, after they've beaten them down for months, then trading them. It's like, oh God. And it's not just for those guys, but it's for other guys on the team. And you're looking at it and saying like, well, they don't have his back. Like, they're going to have mine when it's my turn to be the whipping boy, you know? Mm. But I think the most frustrating part for me as a player, like I said, when I went in there straight from Boston, was that, you know, like, talk is cheap. You know, I went in and, you know, Dallas Eakins is a fantastic coach. There's another whipping boy who got dragged over the coals. He's a fantastic coach that was dealt just a pure crap hand in a team that would actually listen. I mean, you had a group of players that talked about how they wanted to make the playoffs and talked about how sick they were of losing. And then, you know, by game three, after losing 6-1, they're straight out to the bar till 3 a.m, you know. Mm. Lighten up the nightlife scene in Edmonton. Like, come on, give me a break. You know, like, it was to the point where it was ridiculous, where the lifestyle was way more important than actually playing the game and making the playoffs. But like I said, talk is cheap. You know, even in practice, like, came from a group where you're practicing against, like, guys like Bergeron or Chara, and you're going at each other, like, game intensity. And that's how you get better. That's how you be a playoff contender. That's how you be a champion. And you try to instill some of those values. And we had some other guys that had been on playoff teams. They had the same frustrations. They'd come and practice hard. And there's a group of guys there that, you know, had it was like too cool to try hard, you know, mm-hmm. like derogatory terms for trying too hard in practice. Like, that's the culture, right? And so how do you break that? Well, you come in and try to disrupt, right? And so I think that over the years there have been attempts to disrupt, you know, whether it was Eakins or, you know, I come in there, or Pronger, or like whoever it was, like, different people come in and disrupt. But I know personally it was really hard for me. Like you come in as an older guy, but far from being like one of the better players on the team. So you can be a leader, you know, with experience, but I'm not a game changer. You know, I'm like a number 4 or 5 defenseman. So your voice only goes so far with people that, you know, only respect, you know, how good your toe drag is and whether or not you're out partying, you know. So your voice doesn't carry much weight with people that don't put value on, you know, those aspects that I was bringing from Boston, or that, you know, Dallas was trying to instill in the team. So was it not only frustrating, but it really pissed me off, you know, because it's a waste of years in your NHL career where it's just, you never get those back. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, you see a coach like Dallas get, you know, really, you know, I think just so unfairly treated. You know, like I said, was he perfect? No. And he'd be the first to admit that, you know, he would rather do some of those things different, but taking the blame for, you know, what are you supposed to do with a culture like that?
I always felt that, and I agree with you on that about Dallas. I think he's a really good coach, and I would watch games and then, you know, read the reviews of them. And I mean, you played, you can tell me whether I'm off base or on base on this one. I think it was after game 7 or maybe game 8 that one year you guys had the Western road swing to start down California, and it was a tough one for you. And this is when you started that swarm defense and didn't work. And I think Dallas abandoned it after about game 7 or 8, but then it would get into like game 12, 15, 20. And I would read about how, oh, this swarm defense has to stop. And Edmonton, I mean, is anyone actually watching the game here? Like, they abandoned this, like, games and games ago. Like, from your point of view as a player on that team, you know, how frustrating is it to play, read the commentary afterwards and say, that's not even close to what we're doing?
Well, because it becomes an easy narrative. Like I said, like,
that never happened on TV broadcast, by the way. But like, I would just like to state that.
Shot the print guys, yeah. Clearly.
Purely print and radio.
Yeah. And I hate to rag on, you know, like, you don't want to rag on me. Like, you know, like, we were a bad team. Like, we lost a lot of games. You know, we got scored on a ton. But there is a narrative where it's just easy to write about something and stick to it, or whether it's a player or a concept or whatever it is, it's, you stick to it, and you, it's fun to write negative things and rag on it. And I'm sure the people that call into the show will just, you know, have lots to talk about, and it makes it easy. You know, it's an easy way to talk about a crappy situation. Like I said, you could add any kind of defense or any kind of system, but you know, if you go on a Western swing and your guys are out every single night till 5 a.m, I mean, you're not going to win too many games.
I just got a couple more for me. First of all, you were always active in the Players Association. You have a league job now. I remember 2013 lockout, the morning night came to an end, and that was a long night. We're sitting there in a boardroom in New York where our eyes are glazing over as we're trying to stay awake, waiting for updates. And I remember the first clue that the lockout was coming to an end was a thumbs-up emoji tweet from you, because you were in the room at the time. You were negotiating with the players. And when that came out, a few of us looked and said, we'd better start checking. And that was your way of breaking that the lockout was over. But is it difficult for you to, quote-unquote, switch sides? Kevin Westgarth was part of the negotiating team now. He works for the league. George Parros was involved. He obviously works for the league. You were big into the Players Association and some of the controversies it went through. Was it difficult for you to switch to the league?
Well, no. I mean, I think that, you know, through union work, through environmental work, like with NHL Green stuff, I had made, you know, a number of relationships with people at the league, working relationships where, you know, you really get to see things from their side as well. And I think like any good business, which it is, and partnership, which it is, you can't just see it from your side. And I think that, I've mentioned this to you before, but the strength of the union's not always, you know, a group of players that, you know, have that viewpoint from, I get what we want as players, but how is the business, you know, side of it? How is the NHL side of it? We need to see it from both sides. This is a business relationship. I think that there's times when, obviously, in a lockout and negotiations, that emotions run high, mm-hmm. and you know, mm-hmm. Sometimes throwing fuel on those emotions is actually a tactic, you know, to help things out. And I think there was a group of us, you know, on the negotiating committee, you know, some names that you mentioned, that, you know, always had that, you know, just pause and alternative view and different take on some of the situations. And I think really lent, you know, maybe a calmer voice to some of the negotiations, and I think really helped, you know, Shane Doan being one of those, Marty St. Louis, extremely important guys in the negotiating room that were able to treat it, like I said, like a partnership, like a business deal, and break through some of the emotional barriers that I think were happening that tend to block a deal like that. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I you know, proud union work, you know, as a player. Proud now that I actually get to work with the union on a lot of stuff. Our industry growth fund, we're just out at, you know, WickFest with Haley Wickenheiser, you know, a jointly funded thing that we get to do with IGF right alongside the PA. So I think that it's good to have guys like us that have been on both sides at the league. You know, we're a bridge. We get it. You know, we get both sides of it. We get, you know, how people feel and, you know, the perspective from both sides. So, you know, I think it's a great advantage to make sure that we're utilized in maybe any difficult situations.
Mm-hmm. Elliot mentioned earlier, Andrews, about the Calgary-Tampa Stanley Cup final. You won the Stanley Cup with the Boston Bruins, obviously, after that happened. If you hadn't won with Boston in 2011, beating the Vancouver Canucks, how much would that Calgary-Tampa series have haunted you? We had Mike Liut on a couple of weeks ago, and you know, he's still the ghost of 1981 Canada Cup. You can still tell that it's very much with him. Would that series have been more profound in your mind had you not won later with Boston?
Yeah, it would have been horrible. I mean, I'm sure it still is for some of the guys. I know that right away it was erased basically. As soon as you lift the cup, it's like, what lost? You know, like, you know, obviously it still hurts and you have, you know, tough memories about it. But I would sit there and you'd replay memories from certain aspects of the game, whether it was, you know, Jelena's close goal. But there's always this one Marcus.
Why no timeout at that point?
Oh, God, I don't know. There's always this one Marcus Nielsen play, I think, too, in overtime that hit the post. And, you know, you just see it. Sometimes you're on the perfect angle on the ice where you see the puck and you know just how little of a difference it is to actually go in. And so there's certain aspects that you replay over and over and over, and you get those what ifs. And to my point of, you know, replaying, like, you know, what you'd do with the cup and how crazy Calgary would have been and this and that. Like, you really do. It happens. Like, it keeps you up at night, not only in the series, but, you know, you'll find yourself kind of daydreaming about it late, you know, years later. So the what ifs are tough. The win definitely puts those to bed, but I think that it you know that there's guys on that team that, you know, never got that chance to erase that, right? And, you know, you genuinely feel horrible, like, because I'm assuming that they probably feel the same way I did up until I won.
Last one for me. Next month, Hockey Day in Canada, Swift Current, number one, bundle up.
Five layers. over-unders on five layers.
Number two, you're going.
Yeah.
You're hosting a breakfast there for the principals, right?
Yeah, Declaration of Principles mm-hmm. breakfast with community leaders, and it sounds good. It's taking shape right now, so it should be good.
And so any other roles you're going to have there?
I think I'm playing the alumni game.
Yes.
I hear there's a draft, too. Which,
oh, really, eh?
My last draft didn't go so hot, so yeah. I might go a little higher.
You guys should do it like the Players All-Star Draft that's now banned. Like, alcohol should be involved.
We really should. You know, and I was going to shoot this idea by you. I mentioned it earlier.
Oh, yes, you said the playoffs.
So speaking on good TV.
Yeah.
So I know that you guys, I listened to your great podcast. That's why I reached out to you. Say, like, this is fantastic. So I know you guys like these kind of ideas, but I can't take credit for it. A good friend of mine brought it up. So you picture the end of the season. You have your teams, you know, 1 through 8. They're all set. Day after the regular season, you know, after the settings are all done, commissioner gets team number one to pick who they're going to go against for the playoffs.
See, Jeff has been all
team
over that.
Team number two picks against
it. See,
I love it.
That would be awesome. And
how
Jeff
awesome
is,
would that be?
Jeff would be the biggest.
I've been all over this one for
I'm
years.
I'm so unoriginal.
Jeff would be
No,
it's so fantastic.
But it's great to hear a player say it. Yeah. But do you think there's any chance a team would ever do it?
Well, think about how do you earn your money as a GM, as a coach, as players? Like, or how many people's voices would be like in that conversation? Like, think of all the different aspects. Like, do you pick a team that you have to travel less for? Do you pick a team that's not physical? Do you pick a team that you have a better record? Who's hot?
Can you see teams like GMs having the balls to do that?
Well, they have to. That's the rules, man. You got to do it. You got to pick. I mean, I think
it would be our highest rated broadcast of the year.
Going away.
By miles.
Going away. That would be, to your point, this would be a spectacular TV show. To have the general managers choosing the ratings for it would be out of this world. And I'm with you. Like, hang on. You guys all made it to the NHL, either as players or executives or coaches. I assume that there's a lot of thick skin. I keep getting proven wrong in situations like this because nobody wants to offend anyone else. And this might be, to some, the most offensive thing they've ever heard. But to a hockey fan, the people that have the nerve to reach into their wallet and pay money to watch hockey, this is golden. This is fantastic. And we talk about growing the game. I think it's, and I selfishly, because like I said, I'm with you on this one. I've been banging it for a while. I think it's a fantastic idea that grows the interest in the game. And none of the majors do it. There are some minor league hockey organizations that do a system like this. I think it's fantastic. I would love it if the NHL did it. This just might be the pro wrestling background.
It would be awesome.
With heels and baby faces. But as a player, your general manager gets up there and chooses a team. Or if another general manager chooses to play against your team, Andrew.
Oh, golden. It'd just be, I mean, especially as the underdog, like,
yeah.
You're like, do it.
It shows us, did you?
But I mean, like, really, I was thinking about it last night because, you know, how would that play out? Like, would the GM come down and talk to the players? Like, who do you guys want to play? Or would it be a purely GM move? Or would it be ask the coach?
It would depend
on
the GM.
You know, is the president trying to sell out the building? You know, so do you go for the rivalry or do you avoid the rivalry? Like, there's so many different things.
The more wins you get, the more you sell the tickets. Like,
it's just, yeah, it, I don't know. I love it. I just would love it.
If Daryl Sutter was the GM, he wouldn't ask any of you.
Well, Daryl would just go for the hardest team right off the bat.
Yeah.
Let's get bloody right early.
This has been a lot of fun. Andrew, thanks so much. Continued success. And we look forward to seeing you in Swift Current for a Hockey Day in Canada. Thanks so much.
Thank you
very
much, guys.
This has been great.
Thanks so much,
Andrew. One Thoughts, the podcast, is brought to you by the GMC Terrain. With cargo space that fits the entire family's hockey bags and available all-wheel drive to keep them safe on icy roads, the GMC Terrain is a compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. GMC Terrain, we are professional grade. And that's Andrew Ferentz. Now, Elliot, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much fire is there with the Oilers' comments?
Doesn't take a lot to ignite them, does it?
sometimes I'm really bad at guessing this. I'll put something in a blog or I'll say something and I'll say, that's going to get a lot of steam. Like, I've really set the world ablaze and it goes nowhere.
Yeah.
And there have been other times I'm thinking that's totally benign. And the next thing I know, my phone is exploding and I'm sitting here going, really? That's what did it?
Like when you say, some players throwing away their career playing Fortnite?
Yes, like that.
As an aside.
As an aside. It's a very good example. I assume those will get attention. I was surprised to hear him say that. You don't hear a lot of guys be that blunt and that honest about it. But what really stood out for me about that was all these years later, Jeff, he's still frustrated at the way that went. It still bothers him that his return home went that poorly.
You always, I think, as a young person, you imagine yourself playing hockey and playing for your hometown team and winning a Stanley Cup with that team, and it's the local boy comes home. And a lot of players have had that dream, and I think if you look at the history of the NHL, generally it doesn't work. Generally, most players go elsewhere to find success. There are so many pressures and demands when you go home, and it doesn't get talked about a lot. I mean, the romantic story of, the returning son, and here he is, he's going to lead the team to the championship glory and all that. Man, when you come home, it's tough because you can't just blank everything out. You can't just say, I'm going to have a nap now for 3 hours, or I'm just going to focus on hockey. There's so many other demands that come along with it, and you live it, and there's all that pressure. And when you're in your hometown, Elliot, as you all know, you've talked to plenty of these guys, you cannot hide. You are that player 24/7.
I think it's different when you're older. I believe that Ferentz had felt at that point in his career, after everything he'd been through in Calgary and Boston, he could handle it. To me, he's just disappointed that for circumstances he doesn't respect, it didn't work. And part of that was obviously the behavior of some of the players, but also hearing him talk about how the players felt really exposed and unprotected was a big problem for him too. Remember a few years ago when Bob Gainey went after those people who were booing Carey Price in the exhibition season?
Don't come to the games.
Yes, that's what I thought of when I listened to Ferentz talk about that. And obviously that was something that players really respected. And if I heard that and heard Ferentz say that, and I worked for the Oilers organization, I would be having a conversation about how often do we have to go out there and maybe stand up for some of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's harder when things aren't going well, and that whole organization feels like it's under siege right now, so it's harder for that. But I think that's something they've got to consider. Do we have to do a better job of protecting our players?
Was interested in his comments about losing Stanley Cup final to Tampa. And in sports, as we all know, unless you're at the exceptional level, you lose more than you win when it comes to sports. And sometimes you lose on a big stage, and sometimes you lose numerous times on a big stage. And I'm always curious how people deal with that and what helps wash it away. And I know I keep coming back to a Mike Liu conversation about 81 and the Canada Cup, but there's numerous players that I'm sure that can't shake a big loss on a big stage. Now, the big cleanse for him was 2011, certainly when the Boston Bruins won, and all of a sudden you can laugh about what happened in that series against Tampa. But that's always going to be for him, one of those what ifs. What if I hadn't won in 2011? Would that be the one thing that I always hang my hat on? I came that close. And whether it's Joe Thornton may have this his entire life, although he's had a lot of success in his career. I got that close, but we couldn't close the deal. Is that something that hangs on to you maybe for the rest of your life?
Tell you a story. As you know, when I worked at the CBC, I was the host of the CFL on CBC panel. And there was one time we were talking about the Grey Cup, and the three guys I worked with were Sean Millington, who had at least one Grey Cup ring and probably more, Greg Frères, who had at least one and I think two, and Kahari Jones, who didn't have any. And once I introduced them and I said, there's Sean Millington who's won, there's Greg Frères who's won, and I got caught and I was like, there's Kahari Jones who hasn't. And I remember players rarely said anything to me about stuff I said on the air, but one player pulled me aside and said he was watching that game and he thought that was BS. he said to me, you know, I don't know you that well. You generally come across as a very decent guy, but I hated you watching that. And he said, you know, it's hard to win. And maybe Kahari Jones was the quarterback, and the quarterback's the guy who makes the most money and gets the most attention. Yeah. But 99.9% of the time you lose, it's not one guy's fault. It's a whole team's fault or other things happen. And that conversation always stuck with me. And obviously we rate people by how much they won, because ultimately that is the name of the game, and there's some fairness of that. But that conversation, as I've gotten older and understand there's a lot deeper meaning to a lot of things, that if you lose, yes, sometimes you are the fault, the reason a team loses, but a lot of the time, you know, there's things that happen that you either have no control over or you're just part of it. And I'm a lot more sensitive to that. I don't think, for example, when, you know, do people think less of Charles Barkley because he never won an NBA title? I don't think that way anymore. Like, who's the NHL equivalent? You know, a guy who never won. Who would be a guy who played a long time? Like, oh, here's a perfect example. Do you think less of Curtis Joseph because he never won a Stanley Cup?
Gilbert Perreault,
no,
Marcel
like,
Dion.
I don't. I think as you get older, you realize his career is really incredible. So that is something I do think about quite a bit.
And I think as you get older, too, generally, you start to think that the wins don't necessarily mean what you think they mean. You see this a lot in fighters, that when they climb the top of that mountain, they finally win a championship and they sit in the dressing room by themselves, there's almost an empty feeling that comes with it. Sure, the winning is one thing and it's fantastic and you join a certain fraternity, but I think that as you get older, you have a sort of greater perspective. And Elliot, I know it's a cliche, but I think you realize that at the end of the game, the queen and the pawn go back in the same box. That was Andrew Ferentz, ex-NHLer, joining us on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Thank you for joining us on this special edition of the podcast. We'll be back in a couple of days.